Welcome to the Biota.org Interviews Podcast. This is part of the special series taken from the audio of the Biota 2 conference. Today's speaker is Richard Dawkins.
I'm talking about the view from the real world, the real world being, of course, the world of biology. But as biologists go, I'm pretty far from the real world, so don't lose heart. I have always been fascinated by the distinction between those facts about life on this planet which just happen to be true on this planet, and those facts about life which, to a greater or lesser extent, and I think there may be a continuum here, have got to be true of life anywhere. And as I say, there's probably going to be a continuum between those. I've always wanted to study what you could call universal biology as opposed to the parochial terrestrial biology that we have on this planet. To me, it's as if we all lived on, say, Madagascar, and for some reason we never travelled anywhere else but Madagascar, and so our only view of life was lemurs and the other things that live on Madagascar. And we probably get a fairly good idea of what life was all about. But it might occur to some far-sighted people in this Madagascan culture that by looking at the principles of life on Madagascar, you might be able to work out what life might be like on the rest of the planet. Now, maybe we are on the equivalent of Madagascar. Maybe there is life on other planets. Even if there isn't, it's a very worthwhile goal to think about the principles of life in general as opposed to just life here. Stuart Kaufman in 1985 put it in this way: one way to underline our current ignorance is to ask, if evolution were to recur from the Precambrian, when early eukaryotic cells had already been formed, what organisms in 1 or 2 billion years might be like, and if the experiment were repeated myriads of times, what properties of organisms would arise repeatedly? What properties would be rare, what properties were easy for evolution to happen upon, which were hard. A central failure of our current thinking about evolution is that it has not led us to pose such questions, although the answers might in fact yield deep insight into the expected character of organisms. Kaufman's not the only person to have thought along those lines. What I particularly like about his way of putting it is the statistical aspect. He's imagining repeating the experiment millions of times and getting an actual statistical feel for the kinds of things which statistically would be likely to arise many times and the kinds of things which wouldn't. Another way to think of it statistically, of course, is to imagine many planets, to spread your statistical net geographically over the universe and say, if you took a statistical sample of life all around the universe, what principles would be general in life all around the universe, what principles would be rare. The advantage of Kaufman's thought experiment is that you can separate off the otherworldliness of planets. They have different temperatures, different gravitational fields, and so on, and imagine even on this planet, even with the same conditions, what would happen if you were to run the experiment a statistical sample of time. Of course, we don't know the answer to that, but what I want us to talk about, and by the way, I think we should, is it okay if we sort of discuss time to time. What I thought we might do is think around those problems. Obviously, artificial life experiments and computers is one way of doing it. And Chris Langton, in his manifesto for the first artificial life conference in Los Alamos, put it this way: without other examples, however, it is extremely difficult to distinguish essential properties of life, properties that must be shared by any living system in principle, from properties that are incidental to life, but which happen to be universal to life on Earth due solely to a combination of local historical accident and common genetic descent. Since it is quite unlikely that organisms based on different physical chemistries will present themselves to us to study in the foreseeable future, our only alternative is to try to synthesize alternative life forms ourselves, artificial life. Life made by man rather than by nature. One more longish quote before I finish on those. I had a slide of each of these, but I haven't to read them out. In 1976, towards the end of The Selfish Gene, I affirmed then my fascination with universal biology as opposed to parochial, earthly biology. And in particular, I conjectured that one of the principles which would turn out to be universal anywhere in the universe would be that all life is Darwinian life. I quote, this is from The Selfish Gene, "The laws of physics are supposed to be true all over the accessible universe. Are there any principles of biology which are likely to have similar universal validity? When astronauts voyage to distant planets and look for life, they can expect to find creatures too strange and unearthly for us to imagine." Now that's debatable, actually. But is there anything which must be true of all life, wherever it is found, and whatever the basis of its chemistry? If forms of life exist whose chemistry is based on silicon rather than carbon, or ammonia rather than water, if creatures are discovered which boil to death at minus 100 degrees centigrade, if a form of life is found which is not based on chemistry at all, but on electronic reverberating circuits, will there be any general principle which is true of all life? Obviously, I do not know, but if I had to bet, I would put my money on one fundamental principle. This is the law that all life evolves by the differential survival of replicating entities. The gene, the DNA molecule, happens to be the replicating entity which prevails on our own planet. There may be others. If there are, provided certain other conditions are met, they will almost inevitably tend to become the basis for an evolutionary process. Right, so let's talk about this. I've mentioned one general principle which I think I believe in, which is that all life has got to be Darwinian life. And it's open for argument. I mean, there may be people here who don't think that that's true. And I don't know how strong I now feel about that. I think the form of the logic is not absolutely watertight. It's rather that if you look at every alternative suggestion that's ever been made, there is no other alternative which even in principle could account for life. Now, that's one step further than many people are prepared to go, because, as you know, there is at least one other theory that has been proposed, which is Lamarck. I'm not talking about what Lamarck himself said, which is a bit more obscure, but we use the word Lamarckism for a theory which is a combination of the inheritance of acquired characteristics and the principle of use and disuse, which is the principle that the more you use a bit of yourself, the bigger it gets. If you couple that with inheritance of acquired characteristics, then various people have thought that you could get a recipe for evolution. And many biologists have gone so far as to say that there's nothing special about Darwinism. Lamarckian evolution would have been just as good. It's just that, as it so happens, acquired characteristics are not inherited, and that's just tough. That's therefore a contingent fact, not a necessary fact. It just happens that acquired characteristics are not inherited. If only they were, then we could easily have a Lamarckian form of life. And who knows, there may be planets in the universe where acquired characteristics are inherited, in which case we could have a Lamarckian form of evolution. I would deny that, because I think that if you follow through the logic of the Lamarckian process, it turns out that it doesn't work in principle, never mind about the fact that acquired characteristics are not inherited. Even if they were, it wouldn't work for two reasons. First, there's no general reason why we should expect that acquired characteristics should be improvements. If you think about the characteristics that we acquire, most of them are injuries, or they're wearing out. Machines, the more you use a bit of a machine, the more worn out it becomes, and you eventually have to replace it. It's really a rather odd feature of animal bodies that the more you use a bit of it, the more you exercise a particular muscle, the bigger it gets, the more you walk on your feet, on your bare feet, on sharp pebbles, the harder and tougher your skin gets. Now, of course, because that happens to be true, if only we inherited that characteristic, then it could lead to an improvement of the famous blackness arms, or the giraffe stretching for the trees, and so getting a longer neck, which is then inherited. But in general, there is no general reason why we should expect that acquired characteristics would be beneficial. And exactly. And so you have to have a Darwinian process coming along afterwards to clean up the good ones and get rid of the bad ones. So the message from that is that if acquired characteristics were inherited, then you might get a kind of Lamarckian evolution, but only with a Darwinian underpinning to choose the good bits, the good acquired characters, and get rid of the bad ones. I guess that's right. I mean, but what I would draw from that is that it is the Darwinian selection that's crucial for improvement. And we're then left with the question, well, where does the variation come from? Maybe it's random, maybe it's not random, maybe there's something about use and disuse or something of that sort, maybe there are acquired characteristics. So we could imagine a form of life in which the mutation stage of the Darwinian process was non-random in that sense. And it would still have to be Darwinian insofar as it leads to adaptive improvement. Right. Okay, I can see that. Yeah. Right. Yeah, okay. The other objection is the point about bits getting used a lot, getting bigger. Even if that's true, it doesn't seem to me to be anything like powerful enough to explain more than very, very crude and dirty adaptation. It does work perhaps for the blacksmith's arms. The more you use a particular muscle, the bigger it gets, and that could be an adaptive thing. But almost all adaptation that you can think of that's of any finesse, think of the eye, which is one of Darwin's favourite examples. The acuity, the beauty of the focusing of the eye, the iris diaphragm stopping down, the opening out again. None of that comes about through the rule that the more you use it, the bigger it gets. The lens of the eye does not become washed clean and clear by photons whizzing through it, which would be the analogy for the blacksmith's arms for improving the acuity of the eye. The Darwinian principle, of course, will, as Darwin said, since it's ceaselessly scrutinizing every detail, the tiniest little improvement, however obscurely buried in the depths of the animal it is, the tiniest little improvement will have some kind of statistical reflection upon the survival chances of the animal, and therefore the genes for it get favored. So the Darwinian mechanism is so much finer and more powerful at producing detailed adaptation than the principle of use and disuse. There is a third possible objection to Lamarckian evolution, which is, and I'm not sure, this is open for discussion, I'm not sure whether this one counts as contingent or necessary. I will mention it, because I think it's interesting. Lamarckian inheritance depends upon a particular kind of embryology, namely what I've called recipe embryology as opposed to blueprint embryology. And this is a genuinely interesting question about life in general. Do we have to have recipe embryology as we happen to have it on this planet, or could you imagine a form of life that has blueprint embryology? And the difference is this. In blueprint embryology, there is a one-to-one mapping between the genetic instructions, the blueprint, and the phenotype, the body. And one-to-one mapping means that it's reversible. A blueprint is reversible in the sense that if you've got the house, or you've got the car, whatever it is, you can reconstruct the blueprint because there is one-to-one mapping. You could go around the house with a tape measure and measure dimensions of every room, heights of every room, and you can reconstruct exactly, at least an equivalent of the architect's original plan. You cannot do that with a recipe, and you cannot do that with an animal body or a plant body. There is the instructions. If they are obeyed in the right order, in the right sequence, in the right circumstances, then the instructions with great precision will give rise, by the processes of embryogenesis, will give rise to a baby and then to an adult. But you can't take that creature, that adult creature, and turn it back into its genetic recipe. Perhaps there is a form of life where that could be done. Perhaps there is a form of life somewhere, not on this planet, a form of life somewhere where the way in which genetics works is not that you have a segregated Weissmannian germline, which is inherited down the generations and which within each generation has a causal influence upon embryogenesis, but there are no back arrows. Perhaps on some other planet, the way genetics works is that the adult body is scanned in exactly the same way as we can scan a page with a Xerox machine. It would have to be a three-dimensional Xerox machine of some sort, and turned into a blueprint, which is then fed into the next generation. Now, that's a radically different kind of embryology from the embryology that we have, and there's no reason at all why somebody studying artificial life shouldn't invent a form of life that has blueprint embryology as opposed to recipe embryology. At least I don't know if there's any reason why they shouldn't. I mean, it could be tried, and the result might well be that you would discover that there's some fatal objection to it. Well, I suppose that's right, isn't it?
And in fact, Richard Lang invented the drug, which started off with only the organism.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, but I mean, the von Neumann speculation is just that. I mean, it's a speculation for if only we could make a von Neumann machine which worked by scanning, then it would have the property of starting a new form of life. But what I'm talking about is a more practical question. How do you actually do the scanning? That brings me on to the next, but one. So I better carry on. The next fact about life in the real world here is that genetics is digital and not analog. And I naturally think of the question, does it have to be digital, or will analog genetics do? I don't think I've met Simon Winter, but I notice on the program that I think he's going to talk about that. Is that Chris Winter, I'm so sorry.
Yes, in some way.
Okay, well, I suggest we wait and hear what he has to say. I will just say that the question may or may not be confounded with the question of high fidelity, which is another very interesting question. DNA as a genetic system has very, very high fidelity, and as you know, it's not totally high fidelity. There are mutations, which is why evolution can happen, because we do need mutation. Mutation almost certainly is not an adaptive feature, by the way. Mutation is, insofar as natural selection works on mutation rates, it probably is optimizing towards a mutation rate of zero. But fortunately for all of us, it never actually gets there, because if it did, then the evolution would grind to a halt. But it's constantly working to reduce mutation rate, to increase the perfection, the high fidelity of the genetic code. And it's a point of orthodoxy, really, among biologists, that it's got to be very high fidelity or Darwinism wouldn't work. And again, this is one of my general questions. Does that have to be true? Could you imagine a form of life which has a very noisy genetic system, or does the genetic system have to be of extreme high fidelity? And in turn, does that mean that it has to be digital, or could there be a very high fidelity analog system? I haven't thought very much about that. I think you possibly have to be a chemist or a physicist to think about that. I did think about it a little bit in connection with memes, which I don't know whether that's relevant to this. Shall I talk about memes a little bit? One of the main objections to memes, the genetic, the cultural equivalent of a gene, one of the main objections is precisely this, that people say, well, memes are bound to be of low fidelity. They're bound to have a high noise level in the intergenerational transmission. And so the whole thing will collapse for the same reason as Fleming Jenkin thought that Darwinism would. And there's a lot in that. You could think of it in terms of the children's game of Chinese whispers, which Americans call telephone. And you know, you have a line of children, and you say whisper something into the ear of the first child, and then he whispers it to the second. And by the time you've got down to the 20th child, the message is garbled beyond recognition. actually, since I haven't got any slides, I might do a demonstration. So, can I have a bit of paper? Hang on. I have it. Now imagine that we've got our Chinese whispers line of children, and what we are passing down is a drawing of a Chinese junk. So we draw a Chinese junk and show it to the first child, and the first child then takes it and attempts to draw a Chinese junk, which he then shows to the second child, and so on. And once again, we don't need to do the experiment. We all know that by the end of the 20th child, the drawing will bear almost no resemblance to the original drawing whatever. So there's a very high mutation rate of memes in this case. But now suppose instead of asking the child to draw a Chinese junk, we teach the first child to make a Chinese junk using rules which have a certain normative, self-normalizing property. And I'm going to make a Chinese junk in origami, which has that property. So imagine that you're the first child in the line, and I'm teaching you to make a Chinese junk, and it's a little... It'd be helpful if I came. No, it wouldn't, because of the light there. I think I'll just do it rather swift, is it? So you can't really expect to see what I'm doing. But the kind of things that I would be passing on to the child would not be drawing it like this. I would say, fold the four corners into the center. Now that's self-normalizing, because the rule is, fold it into the center as accurately as you can. And we know that some children will do it ineptly, as I'm doing it now, because I'm doing it in a hurry. And other children may do it well. But because what's being passed on is not a scan of the phenotype, which it was in the first case, where the child is looking at the drawing of the junk and attempting to copy it, that's a phenotype becomes the genotype of the next generation, becomes the genotype of the next generation, etc. What we've got here is a separate germline, which consists of rules which are self-normalizing in the sense that they are things like folded in exactly into the center as accurately as you can. This is a sort of stage on the route to a Chinese junk. That's a catamaran, a double boat. And I can more or less guarantee, I think, that if I had enough time to teach a person sitting there, and he had enough time to teach him, he had enough time to teach her, etc., that the junk that would emerge would not have degenerated at the end of 20 people in the way that the drawing would have done. Just getting to the next stage, which is a box with a couple of lids. This goes through various embryological stages. The next one is a picture in a frame. And then the denouement, which is actually going to be a bit of a flop because I'm doing it in such a hurry. There is the Chinese junk. Now, if you were to get a line of 20 people, and the first one taught the second, and the second taught the third, and the third taught the fourth, of course they won't all be perfect. Of course they'll have mutated. Of course there'll be imperfections in them. But there will not be any trend from the first to the 20th. There may be skilled children along the way, and less skilled children along the way, and the mistakes of the ones halfway along will be corrected by the next ones along, because they will have learnt the rule, and they're not just looking at the finished article, at the phenotype, and drawing it. Now, I don't know whether that's digital or not, but it does seem to me to have a property which immunizes it against the decay which some people have thought was endemic to mimetic transmission. And I invite you to think about other examples of mimetic transmission which appear to have that property. Language, I suppose, does, because although language evolves, there's no doubt about it, nevertheless, there is at least a sufficient resemblance between the language in successive generations that we can all understand each other. We can't understand 10 centuries back, but we can understand perhaps, what, 2 centuries back, I would guess. And people tend to talk with the accents of their parents rather than any other kind of accent. So there's clearly some sort of mimetic transmission. There is at least enough fidelity for us to notice these things. And I don't know how to square that with the expectation that you couldn't have a Darwinism without much higher fidelity than memes apparently have. Right. Now, when we do our artificial life, I suppose you could make distinctions between simulations of whole organisms, whole bodies, or you could imagine an artificial biochemistry, and I don't know if there are any chemists here, but I hope so, because this is one of the things I've always wanted to get discussed among imaginative biochemists. How much of the chemistry of life is necessary, and how much is contingent? If we write down the essential properties of the chemistry of life as we know it, which of them have the freedom to change as we move to other imaginary planets? Obviously, we want to know whether the genetic molecule has to be DNA. Does it have to be a polynucleotide, or will another polynucleotide do? Are there other molecules, other, I suppose they have to be polymers of some sort, which would do the job? You simply have to be a chemist in order to speculate about that. I don't know whether computer simulation helps here or whether it's simply chemical knowledge, chemical intuition, which can help us here. Moving then to the other main class of molecules of life on this planet, proteins, I suppose the thing that really makes proteins special is that their three-dimensional shape, which is crucial to their enzymatic activity, is determined by the one-dimensional sequence of their elements, the amino acids. So that immediately opens up possibilities of easy coding, and that's the possibility that's been exploited by life on this planet, of course. A one-dimensional genetic code in DNA being translated into a one-dimensional amino acid version. And then from that follows the automatic coiling up into a three-dimensional shape. That three-dimensional shape is crucial to the function of the protein. A question I want to ask Kenny, because I think it's very interesting from this point of view, is is the space of protein shape, is the space of all possible protein shapes a continuous space or a discontinuous space? Are there little islands of possible protein shape stuck in a vast sea of impossible ones? Or, putting it in other terms, if you had complete freedom to specify genetic codes, could you, in principle, make a protein molecule and sign your name in it? Or, I mean, could a protein molecule be forced into any shape you like, provided you were clever enough in greening up the right sequence of amino acids? Or are there only certain shapes which are possible? I was led to think about this through playing with biomorphs on the computer, and I found that and I demonstrated these at the first artificial life conference. These creatures, biomorphs that I breed on the computer screen by artificial selection, there's random mutation, there's a kind of embryology which is a tree-growing embryology. It's a branching tree, a recursive procedure which branches and branches and branches, and the genes control various patterns of the various quantitative aspects of the branching pattern. And I was very surprised when I started breeding these by artificial selection, as I was breeding roses or pekingeses. I was very surprised with the power that I had to breed insects and flowers and professors of philosophy and all kinds of things. But I then said, well, can I breed absolutely anything I want? I mean, is the space of all possible biomorphs continuous, in other words, or is it discontinuous? So I tried to breed an alphabet to sign my name, and with limited success, I kind of could do this. I mean, I got a good enough alphabet that people could actually read it, and I think I did in fact post a letter with the address. I wrote a letter. I wrote it to John Maynard Smith, and it was entirely written in a genetically bred alphabet, and it did get there. But it's not perfect, and the same kind of question could be raised about proteins, and I haven't the foggiest idea what the answer is, and there may be chemists who have. And the same question arises with respect to growth morphology, and is controversial. There are some biologists who have come to be known for some reason as ultra-Darwinists, who are thought to believe that absolutely anything can be done by natural selection. Natural selection is totally powerful to breed anything you like, and if you wanted to breed a sea urchin, sign your name in sea urchins, you in principle could. And there are others who feel that the space of all possible morphologies is discontinuous, and that you're not allowed to simply, embryology or something, the laws of physics or something, doesn't allow you doesn't allow natural selection or artificial selection to steer evolution into any pathways that it might choose. The slide that I had to illustrate that was a rather elegant book cover in which the title of the book was entirely made up of letters of the alphabet on butterflies' wings. So it's a bit of a cheat because the photographer had kind of zeroed in on little tiny bits of patterns on butterflies' wings which looked like letters of the alphabet. But that was just to illustrate that point.
This podcast is covered by Creative Commons. If you use this podcast, either in audio or text form, please include a link back to biota.org as the source of this podcast. I'm Tom Barbalay, and if you're interested in more artificial life-related stuff, please subscribe to the biota.org mailing list. Thank you very much for tuning into this podcast. Look forward to you tuning into the next podcast.